and he's an expert in data mining and computational marketing. As a chief scientist at Amazon.com, he developed predictive models of consumer behavior, including situation-based marketing and customer network value. And he designed applications for recommendations and cross-selling. He currently teaches a course in data mining and e-business at Stanford University, as well as the executive course, Technology, Information, and Innovation. He has a long list of clients, including Alibaba, the Bank of America, BB Capital, Hewlett Packard, Hubert, Berta, Media, JP Morgan, Match.com, Morgan Stanley, OpenBC, SAS, Siemens, Swiss International Airlines, and Yahoo, among others. So please put your hands together and join me in welcoming Andrew Sly.
Great. Thank you. Okay. All right, it's great to be here. Thank you for coming here. I know it's a tough competition with your president downstairs, but I think we have actually some content to share with you. And the content to share with you is about Web 2.0 and Web 3.0 and what all these things mean. I have about an hour, which I decided to do a number of things. First, about 15 minutes, I will give an introduction myself. And that introduction will consist of four parts. We will first go to the true essence of what Web 2.0 and Web 3.0 is about. We will then try to come up with some characteristics and see how it is relevant for retail. In the third part of my introduction, we will talk about the importance of data and how, and that goes also with the keynote you have tomorrow, how it relates to doing experiments, not just doing analysis. And I will close with some small examples which, you know, come from the experience I have. Before introducing the panelists, we then have about half an hour for five panelists, and then we close in the last 5 minutes or so with some Q&A. If you have questions, you can either pass them to the middle and see that they get given to me, or we can try to do it interactively at the end. So that's what we're going to do. First of all, this is the essence of Web 2.0. That is the old world here. The old world used to be that some people who supposedly didn't know stand on top and push the knowledge which they have to downstairs. For instance, in product development, companies figure out what do our customers really want, produce it, and then push it to the customer. What is happening is that this pyramid is turned upside down. So Web 2.0 is turning the pyramid upside down, and sometimes we call this architecture of participation, of having customers participate in the design, of really listen to them, not only indirectly, but directly through blogs, some of you have heard of, or other things. So sometimes I wonder whether it is a wisdom of the crowds which might be able to unleash through the right architectures of participation here, or whether it's more a stupidity of the crowds, or a tyranny of the crowds, or a madness of the crowds, which actually is exhibited here in this world of Web 2.0. So as we spend the next hour together, I invite you to think hard what switches you need to set in order for the wisdom of the crowds to emerge and not just random rubble to surface. I made this table last night for you after discussing with the panelists what we want to really bring out here today. And today, 2006, I go back 10 years. That was right after the Netscape IPO in 95. And then I go back yet another 10 years in 1986. That actually happens to be the time when I came to the United States the first time. So 10 years ago, most of us were familiar with companies like Amazon.com, and we call this, in retrospect, Web 1.0. It was a read-only web. You couldn't do much writing on that web. Yes, there were early things like Amazon reviews, but they really were the exception. When in retail we were thinking about customers, our goal was to increase the barriers of exit. You might have heard about how can we create stickiness? How can we make it hard for people to go somewhere else? Let's contrast this to Web 2.0, which we sometimes call the live web, and you'll see in a moment why we do that. That is the read-write web. Customers have become producers. It's about co-creation. And that happened because we lowered the barrier of entry dramatically. There are 40 million bloggers, people who write on a regular basis and publish their thoughts. 40 million. That you can only do if it's trivially easy for people to participate. I want to give you one example here, and that is, if I go to my own website here, and I'm curious, who writes to that website? Who comments on what's happened on our website? And I want to show you some things how you can find that out. So one, since I mentioned here as an example, blogs, is I can say, well, who is blogging about my website? And these are two entries, one from yesterday, the other one from then before you. And you can scroll down and find out all those people who, in this case, talking about what I'm doing. These are not famous people. These are not big companies. These are individuals who might have happened to have heard a talk or who might have come across to some of the things I'm doing. Another way is to leave little tags on people's sites. So as you see something interesting, you might know the notion of bookmarks, which used to be stored on your computer. And why do people use bookmarks? Well, it's useful for them. They want to find something again. For instance, if you go shopping, you might want to remember where you saw those pants. So now, the notion here is that you can leave those bookmarks not on your own computer, but you can leave them at some other computer, and you can share them. So initially, just the convenience that if you have several computers, you can have one set of bookmarks. That pyramid got turned upside down. And you're sharing your bookmarks with the rest of the world. And what I'm doing on this page is I'm looking up who has bookmarked my page. Who are these people? What do they say here? Some is Spanish, some is German, some is English, some is Chinese. So this is a way of writing to the web. They do it for themselves. They don't get paid for that. They want to remember things. They have their own comments. So that is the second example I wanted to give to you. It's a very low barrier of entry for people. They just write a little word. Like this guy writes, Weigand, people, Amazon, profile, Web 2.0, technology, e-commerce. These are the words he used as tags for me. And then the third thing, of course, is you can say, who talks about my website is actually linking to my website. And these are things where we listen to the participation which we created. At the heart of it, of course, is data. We'll talk about, we'll see that's one of the things going throughout the morning, will be the importance of having data. Let's go back to the table I made for you. I think we understand the read-only web compared to the read-write web. Now, the next point here is that of taxonomy, which used to be the controlled way that we tried to force people to use certain words. You all remember content management systems and the pain behind them, product authority, and the hard thinking whether my mobile phone actually should be under electronics or under phones or under maybe camera, never finding stuff. Taxonomy, tongue-in-cheek, has been replaced by tagsonomy. That is the wisdom of the crowds. If people classify it in a certain way, well, it just is that way. Those of you who have a philosophy education might know Ludwig Wittgenstein, who in the Tractatus said, it's basically meaning equals use. There's nothing behind a term beyond of how people use the term. The third dimension I want to bring out here is that of a static web versus a temporal web. So static means that the metaphors are that of space. A link, I click on a link and I go somewhere. The page I showed you about Viking.com is basically an up-to-date but static page. I'm not writing what I had for breakfast. In contrast, what people call the live web has very strongly embraced the temporal dimension. Actually, time has become the main ordering parameter on the live web. At Web 1.0 companies at the heart, like Amazon.com or maybe like most of your company's web pages, time doesn't play a role. On Web 2.0, time is a very central element. That has implications on search. That Google's idea of using the expression of relevance of authors in the author-driven web, namely putting in links in their PageRank algorithm to show you the most relevant links, to show you the most relevant pages, has been at least enhanced by taking the time dimension into account. What does that mean to your products? It means that the product life cycle is much more strongly now to be represented in the live web than it was before, where people could just see maybe whether something is still in stock or whether it's already out of stock. Fourth dimension here is push versus pull. I know that's a dimension you heard in many different cases over the years. Here's how I mean it. Let's talk about discovery. Discovery 20 years ago was somebody sending me an email. Yes, actually there was email 20 years ago. Somebody sending me an email saying, check this out. And then maybe there was some BBS, some newsletter attached. And some companies actually still do this sort of email newsletter thing, which is just totally the wrong medium, because email is really for one-to-one communication and not a push medium. And it's only a question, I think, of at most a couple of years for that to disappear and move into the RSS feed world, where you use the social structure of others to reorganize your feeds. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. 10 years ago, discovery was based on hyperlinks. That means authors were under control what they are willing for you to see. Because the author, say, the company which has the website, decides for you it's good to get information about this product, namely the following information. There was no role for others. Sometimes called Web 1.5 is search. Why? The initial problem of finding stuff very quickly changed over to a problem of showing the most relevant stuff on top. So from an information desert, we moved to information sea. If you enter your favorite company as a name, you probably have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of websites which use that name. So search is sometimes called Web 1.5 because it allows us in a not very efficient way, but to still get some feeling about what the discourse about the products or about the services you're offering might be. What is discovery in 2006? Discovery in 2006 is based on social relations. So in some way we go a full circle back to a few hundred years ago when we might have lived in some villages and basically our life was governed by the social relations of those villages. But now it's the social relations of the global village of a billion people who participate. It is who are the influencers there? Who are the early adopters? Who do I trust? Are there global reputation systems? Secondly, it's discovery based on metadata customers produce. 7 years ago, 1999, I started a company with a former PhD student of mine called Mood Logic. Mood Logic is in the entertainment space and has as its goal to help you find, to help you discover music you actually don't know about. And the idea we had was to say, well, let's use people to generate the metadata for a song. So I developed a survey, 35 questions, and after a couple of years, we had 1 billion explicit ratings from people who care about the music. We didn't pay them anything. They just like to do it, and we gave them an avenue to express themselves. And it's the best metadata music piece on a song level that exists. So these were the 2 points. Discovery based on social relations, and social is used in a broad sense here, not just the people you physically, you know, are close to. Can be people you share interests with, people you want to be influenced by, people you want to follow. And the other one, getting other people to do work for us. And that is the main thing, is to create metadata. The last point I just want to very briefly mention, because I think you're all aware of it, how we have moved from a supply-driven advertisement, from a supply-driven world, let's say, in clothes manufacturing, to much more of a demand-driven advertising and a demand-driven manufacturing. Demand-driven advertising, for example, is Google. Google lives in the intention economy. That I have the intention to find something, I enter that search term in Google, and boom, I get hit with a few ads which are relevant of my query. How relevant are they? Well, it's a little sad, actually, that it is about 0.1% of people click on ads, to be precise, in the AdSense context. That means they're 99.9% irrelevant. It's still not great, but apparently still better as before, and makes up for $100 billion market capitalization, which is significant. From there, we have moved to much more of a demand-driven, user-created content. And for that, I actually might to quickly jump to a slide as an example. And that is here, how we moved from clicks, and you're only able to click on something which is shown, to search. That was the example I gave you with Google. But then we move from intention to attention. And an example of attention is this tagging, where the amount of specificity increases. What do you mean by that? If I find something I'm interested in, and I'm going to add a tag to that, then a descriptor that I use to assign something to that object, that means I have found something which my attention is on. And the example I want to give you is Delicious. And here is a person with his name, Lawrence Lee. And he has certain websites, Google Maps, Housing Maps, History of Sampling, and Center at Stanford. He has those things tagged. For instance, he uses the tag maps for Housing Maps. So Delicious, I just got to know about a year ago, and that was before they were even funded. That's what the office looked like in about May last year. In December 2005 already, they were sold to Yahoo. And they made between $10 and $100 per user they had. So if you were a user who had 100 tags there, basically Delicious made something like between 10 cents and a dollar for each entry you made. So there's discovery. You can follow a tag to discover a topic. What other uses of the word maps are there? You can follow a user and say, what is Lawrence Lee interested in addition to the housing maps? And thirdly, you can say, who are the people who are interested in this website? And you discover other people. So to summarize, what I wanted to show you in my brief introduction was that we move from a world where manufacturing, where information, think about France, the Académie Française saying, this is how you have to speak, top-down level to a bottom-up level. And in some way, we could say from one to many, via a many to one, to a many to one world. There are many more examples than Delicious, which I showed you. Flock.com allows you to tag blogs. Music Strands allows you to tag songs. Flickr.com allows you to tag photos. Actually, I'm curious, who of you has a Flickr account, just to get a feeling? It's about 10 people, I think, here. And there are even companies, 43 Things, which was done by the person who at Amazon.com had the initial idea of the recommender systems, which allows you to tag your goals in life. So all these examples have in common that we have created avenues for people to provide data. While I ask the panel to come up on stage, I want to give you the preview of what's happening next half hour. In this world of data, and actually I have problems with the microphone here, I'm not sure why. In this world of data here, we can make the distinction between explicit data, where people tell us something specifically, and implicit data, clicks which people leave on the way anyways. So as we move through the speakers of the panel, we will start with implicit data, and then move to explicit data. Now, since we don't have much time, it's more of a dialogue I will have with the panelists than a big, wild panel discussion. So I would like to start with Dr. Bruce D'Ambrosio. Bruce was a professor at Oregon State University and started about 6 years ago a company called Cleverset. Cleverset is a second generation recommendation engine. If you think about Amazon.com, Amazon is a first generation engine. So the point is that I want to learn from Bruce what has changed in those 10 years in making recommendations. What are the basic ideas for a retailer like people here in the audience in the space of product recommendations?
Thank you, Andreas. Good morning. I think a couple of things have happened. One is that the ways in which we can leverage implicit data have advanced tremendously. So in Amazon, web recommendation systems, the kind of implicit data, what I mean by implicit data is what we can get from observing the visitor from observing the web as a whole. In web 1.0 systems, that is largely offline or post-analysis. We can look at, for example, people who bought this product, what other products did they buy? What's happened in Web 2.0 is that's become much more interactive than ever. The implicit data that we can extract is not just offline or session level data, it's also minute to minute, second to second, actual interactive information about how visitors are behaving and how they're expressing their intent and their goals through their instant second level activities. Another thing that's happened.
So could we say it this way, that whereas Web 1.0 was a vendor-centric web, which focused on the products. In Amazon's big matrix, people bought X, also bought Y. People clicked at X, also clicked at Y. The person ultimately is taken out. The situation they're in is taken out. Whereas here, understand that in Web 2.0, it moved from a vendor-centric web to a user-centric web, where you actually estimate some hidden states of where in the process of creating and maintaining product space awareness the potential buyer or information seeker might stand.
Yes, and understanding, so the key there, exactly right, is understanding not just the relationship between products, but the relationship between visitors or shoppers and products. And relationship between this particular visitor and the product space, where they are in their understanding of the product space, what their goals are in terms of how they view the product space, which, as you pointed out, is not necessarily how the retailer views the product space. The second, I think, major development is in the way we view integration and delivery of services. That the sort of one buzzword or one description we came up with last night was the notion that the web is your website. That in Web 1.0, there was this notion of stickiness and trying to capture the visitor's attention on your website. Well, in fact, today the understanding, I think, is that the entire web is your website. Simple examples of that are catalogs like Google or Google are now seen not as competition, but as sources of new extended components of your website and of